Hasn't science already proven that the idea of a creator God is wishful thinking? After over 2,000 years, what evidence can possibly be marshaled to make the case that the gospel writers' accounts are trustworthy? Doesn't atheism provide the best explanation for what we understand about life today? From angry atheist to born-again Christian, my interview with J. Warner Wallace is next here on the Soaring Eagle Radio Show.
Hello, and welcome to Soaring Eagle Radio. Your host is Mike Spaulding. Get ready to be challenged and encouraged as you consider today's news and Mike's commentary from a biblical perspective. Now, let's join Mike.
Welcome to the Soaring Eagle Radio Show. I'm your host, Mike Spaulding. You may subscribe to the show on iTunes, find us on Facebook, Soaring Eagle Radio, follow us on Twitter at Soaring Eagle Rad, and visit our website, www.soaringeagleradio.com. For the first 35 years of his life, Jim Wallace was a devout atheist. He found the claims of Jesus Christ and those of the gospel writers to be somewhat spurious. How could something that happened 2,000 years ago have any verifiable proof? Christianity, in Jim's mind, was very much like his cold cases, puzzling and mostly dead ends. But then one day, Jim's perspective was challenged and he began to consider the claims of Jesus Christ and the gospel writers in a different light. I'll let Jim's own words tell the story from the preface to his best-selling book, Cold Case Christianity, subtitled A Homicide Detective Investigates the Claims of the Gospels. From page 16 and 17 under the heading From Belief That to Belief In, we read these words. I was 35 years old before I first paid attention to a pastor's sermon. A fellow officer had been inviting me to church for many months, and while I was able to put him off for some time, I eventually acquiesced and attended a Sunday morning service with my family. I managed to ignore most of what the pastor talked about until he began to paint a picture of Jesus that caught my attention. He characterized Jesus as a really smart guy who had some remarkably wise things to say about life, family, relationships, and work. I began to believe that this might be true. While I was uninterested in bowing the knee to Jesus as God, I was at least willing to listen to Jesus as a teacher. A week later, I purchased my first Bible. My friends knew me as an angry atheist, a skeptic who thoughtfully dissected Christians and the Christian worldview, yet I suddenly found myself reading the Gospels to hear what Jesus had to say. Something about the Gospels caught my attention, more as an investigator than as someone interested in the ancient philosophy of an imaginary sage. By this time in my life, I had already served as a patrol officer and a member of the gang detail, the Metro team investigating street narcotics, the SWAT team and the crime impact team investigating career criminals. I'd interviewed hundreds, if not thousands, of eyewitnesses and suspects. I'd become familiar with the nature of eyewitness statements, and I understood how testimony was evaluated in a court of law. Something about the Gospels struck me as more than mythological storytelling. The Gospels actually appeared to be ancient eyewitness accounts. Here to discuss his faith journey, his realization that the evidence for the claims of Jesus Christ contained in the Gospels is well beyond a reasonable doubt, and his new book, God's Crime Scene, is J. Warner Wallace. Welcome to the Soaring Eagle Radio Show, Jim.
Hey, well, thanks so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Well, thank you. Jim, your book, Cold Case Christianity, has been warmly welcomed within the apologetics community. I've personally recommended it to many people, and I've used it as a resource when teaching apologetics classes. Before the book, though, you were an avowed atheist. Would you share with our listeners your faith journey and some of the obstacles that you had to overcome along the way?
Yeah, you know, you basically kind of covered some of it there just in your description of the premise of that book, that kind of opening chapter. I tried to kind of cover a little bit of this because I was one of those guys who really had no interest in spiritual things. Really thought this was all just a matter of mythology because I was a committed philosophical naturalist, and I had been that way, you know, growing up. My dad's an atheist. My mom was kind of a cultural Catholic, but for the most part, we might have attended, you know, when I was very young, on Christmas or Easter, but for the most part, it had no background, no experience of Christianity growing up, and so I just always kind of held it at distance, you know, at arm's length.
Yes.
And the cops that I knew who were Christians, if I'm honest with you, when I would ask them questions about why they were Christians, you know, they were very evidential when it comes to making a case against a bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
Or looking at any piece of evidence related to a crime or investigating a series of crimes. We did a lot of that when I was working in the crime impact team. We were investigating career criminals who would be maybe doing 30 robberies. And so, you know, we would look at the evidence to see if this is our guy. And we would always be very, very conscientious about assessing evidence. This is what we do for a living.
Yeah.
But then when you ask these same guys about why, you know, they accept these broad metaphysical claims, oh my gosh, you know, they didn't have any clue as to why this was true. They couldn't offer any evidential support for what they believed. And I thought that was just a, kind of a broken dichotomy between, you know, the high regard they had for evidence in their professional work and then the low regard they seemed to have for evidence. And what I think were some of the most important questions we could ever ask, right? You know, these are questions that are you know, life questions, metaphysical questions about the nature of reality. And I just didn't, I had no respect for somebody who would look at these kinds of things without taking an evidential approach. I myself knew I could never do that. I could never step out. And, it's funny, we talk a little bit, you know, years later now, it's been, what, 18 years since I became a Christian. And I can tell you that we talk a lot about different kinds of churches and different kinds of preaching. You know, I happened to stumble into a mega church. We were in this neighborhood about 3 years, and I had not gone to church in any of that time. I felt pretty good about that. My wife said, hey, let's go to church on Sunday. And I was more than willing to go as an atheist. My dad has been going as an atheist, you know, his, you know, pretty much his entire life. You know, he actually is in favor of going to church. He thinks it helps to raise good kids, but he sees it as kind of a useful delusion that it's got practical application, but is not really true.
Yeah.
And so I was willing to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And she suggested, no, let's go to this large church that your friend's been, you know, asking us to go to. And I, okay. So I had never really been in a, you know, large evangelical church, you know, a church that was not a Catholic parish, you know, for anything other than like maybe a wedding or a funeral. And as I sat there, this is, you know, kind of felt neat preaching. You know, this is a guy who knows how to throw the ball in a way that we can catch it. And atheists are definitely in his audience. And so he just pitched Jesus as a smart guy. And I'm interested in smart guys. I'm interested in wisdom and fortune cookie wisdom. It doesn't matter to me if the person's even, it is just a kind of ancient cultural wisdom. It doesn't really matter to me what the source was. And so I bought the Bible, my first Bible, just really to assess the kind of the claims or the wisdom, the ancient fortune cookie proverbial wisdom of Jesus. That's why I first started.
Yeah.
And that's what really kind of got me looking at this character of Jesus and his wisdom. And I really had no interest in the supernatural version of Jesus. I had no interest in Jesus as God at all. Just, you know, the source of the ancient wisdom. And that's the thing that started me on this whole path.
Yeah. Very interesting. So from that background, and you touched on it, you saw the dichotomy between your peers, the officers you worked with when it came to their approach to their professional work, and the contrast with their faith, and it not being based on any kind of particular fact or verifiable proof or evidence. So
that's right.
I imagine our listeners then are thinking, this is very interesting. So what led you then to take this step that said, well, if the scriptures are true, if these claims of the gospels are true, if what Jesus says is true, there should be some type of evidence that I can see. What led you to that point?
Well, I think most people who think about evidence, or you know, they watch detective shows, or they you know have some kind of interest in cold case investigations. That's all I do, you know, for a living. I did that for a number of years, probably a dozen years, working nothing but cold case homicides, where, you know, we're looking at cases in which an officer took a report back in, you know, 1980. And since that report was taken, the person he interviewed has passed away. And not only that, the officer who did the interview has passed away. So we're looking at supplemental reports taken by officers who were dead about, and taking eyewitness statements of eyewitnesses who are now dead. Well, that's very similar to what we have in the Gospels. You know, we have the author and the initial witnesses are all not available to us. but we can still assess whether or not this evidence is reliable, the statement is reliable. And this is, you know, there are two forms of evidence. There's indirect evidence and direct evidence. And direct evidence comes down to eyewitness statements. So if you're in the business of assessing direct evidence, well, there's a process in place to do that. I know that's something any of us can do. We actually have jury instructions to help jurors do just that.
Mm-hmm.
And I just simply took the approach that I would take as an investigator to assess whether or not an eyewitness is reliable. And I said, okay, I apply that four-part template to the gospel authors, and if I did that, how well would they measure up? With, you know, if I apply this test, the same test I would offer any set of eyewitnesses, if I apply that test and they do hold up, well, then what do I do with that information? And so that's kind of what the premise of Cold Case Christianity is. I'm just providing a template that people can assess, you know, they can assess whether or not these are reliable. Of course, if they are reliable, that changes the trajectory of how we you know, feel about, how we think about Christianity. But here's the thing that drives me crazy, Mike. You know, my family, my dad's an atheist, but he remarried a woman who became a Mormon in the 60s. And he has six brothers and sisters, six kids he had with his second wife, all raised LDS.
Hmm.
So this is something that is, you know, there are other systems out there,
mm-hmm.
other
yeah.
claims about God that are
yeah.
out there.
Yeah.
And they would, how we assess whether the claims are true makes a difference in terms of whether we accept the claims or don't.
Yes.
You know, and so Christians, for the most part, if I go around the country and I speak around the country, and I can tell you when I ask the question, hey, why are you guys Christians?
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't believe the answers I get.
Yeah.
And I don't think you'd like them, to be honest with you. You're going to get quick answers like, well, you know, I was raised as a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
My parents are Christians. I've always been a Christian. That's the number one largest group answer I get. The
wow.
second one is, well, you know, I've had some experience that I just think validates for me that, you know, I pray. Sometimes I'll say I pray, and I get answers to my prayers. I've had an experience of the Holy Spirit. I've sensed His presence. It's experiential. And the other answer I get typically is, well, I've been transformed by my relationship with Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
All of these are great answers.
Yeah.
But these are the same answers my Mormon family gives me.
That's right, yeah.
So the question becomes, if this is how we're going to determine if something is true, well, get ready, because that's really not sufficient to determine truth from error.
Yeah, that's right.
Because it hasn't done that so far for my own family. So
yeah.
This is the kind of thing that I have to, I'm constantly battling. And for me, as an atheist coming to this for the first time, I knew whatever process, and I did examine Mormonism as an option, because I really, my family is Mormon, so it would have been great to be part of that system with them. But as I examined it, it just couldn't hold up under the same criteria that you use to assess the eyewitness reliability of any claim in the past. I do this for a living. You can apply it to Joseph, as Joseph Smith, and the Book of Mormon, and it will not hold up. So I always say that, you know, I became a Christian the same day I became a not Mormon. Because the same process I applied to both books, I actually read through the Book of Mormon, Doctrines and Covenants, and Pearl of Great Price, before I read through the Old Testament. And I can tell you that the system I applied to both the belief systems validated one while it you know, nullified the other.
Yeah.
So this is the kind of thing that has become like a passion for me,
mm-hmm.
as I speak to churches around the country, is that, hey, we ought to have a different quality of answers. Let me put it this way. If I told you, Mike, that last night I had a vision from God and He told me three things, and I just want to share those three things with you. How in the world would you be able to, you know, verify or falsify that claim? You couldn't, because this is my own private vision. You just
right.
take my word for it. I had a vision of God.
Yeah.
But if I told you, on the other hand, that God came to me personally last night and He had dinner with me in my backyard. We had a barbecue. I had two of my friends over, and afterwards we dug a trench up my new irrigation line on my grass here, and then, you know what, He built a house in my tree. He built a tree house for me. Now, that's a claim that's very different, because that's a claim
right.
that's been made about something that happened publicly.
Mm-hmm.
That I can actually investigate. I can talk to those friends. I could examine, well, did you have a barbecue? You know, did you really dig a trench? Are there any divine attributes of this trench? What's that tree house like? Is it something that's pretty cool? I mean, these are things you can actually examine.
Yes.
Well, this is the nature of our worldview as Christians. It's not about a private vision. It's about a public event called the resurrection.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And if that's true, it changes everything. If it's false, we can just walk away from it.
That's right.
But we can actually respond in a way that's very different from every other theistic system, because those systems are based on private visions. They're not grounded in historical events. If you're a Buddhist, if you're a Hindu, if you're a Mormon, if you're, you know, whatever you may be, those are events. Now, Mormons are they make a claim about a public event.
Mm-hmm.
They make a claim about what happened on the continent called North America over a period of about 1,000 years, from 600 BC to 400 AD. But if you examine those claims about this public history, they just don't measure.
That's right.
So we have a claim that's grounded in history that when you examine it, we can actually verify it.
Yes.
We're very unusual. So when I'm asked that question, why are you a Christian? My hope would be that people would say, well, because I examined this thing evidentially from a historical perspective using all the tools that you would use to examine any historical event, and I determined it was true.
Yes.
Wouldn't that be awesome? That's not what we hear. And that's the thing we're trying, I think both of us have a heart to work at, to help people to have a different kind of response.
Yes.
When asked, why do you think this is true?
Yeah. And that really is the strength of your book, Jim Cold Case Christianity. And I want to encourage any of our listeners who so far have not purchased a copy of that book to go out and get it, because it provides an excellent framework for anyone interested in understanding how you can approach the Gospels and the claims that are made there. In the fashion that Jim's been talking about. But one of the things that it also does is it equips believers on that journey of verifying the details and the facts and the claims of the Gospels. It also equips them to answer the skeptics of Christianity along the way. And in that sense, it's a great apologetic tool. Unfortunately, many folks that I run into, Jim, as you know, I'm a pastor, and
right. So
I frequent those circles, and many of my peers have no interest in apologetics, and it breaks my heart. I encourage them every opportunity that I get, but many pastors that I know personally are just kind of apathetic to the whole apologetic endeavor. And so in response to that, what I've taken to doing is trying to explain to them why apologetics is necessary. And I think if we couch it in those terms, they can grasp the great need and maybe become energized. But you mentioned in your book works of Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, even Bart Erdman's work, which all of those together are what I would define as anti-Christian. They're atheistic in nature, and they're becoming very influential among young people, especially today. I've read numerous Pew Research reports just in the last 6 months that talk about the number of Christians that are no longer identifying themselves as such. I wrote an article recently called "The Rise of the Nuns and the Duns," and those are people who are leaving the church, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right about the lack of interest that I see, and it's a shame because you see it often when I go to an event at a church and I speak at conferences, I speak at churches, I speak at Summit Worldview Conference. We do a thing called College Prep through crossexamine.org with Frank Turek and Mike Adams, where we're preparing young people. So there's lots of different places we speak. But when I go to a church, I can tell you that oftentimes, that the thing I have to do first is win the pastor. Because typically what happens is an elder, somebody who's got the pastor's ear, somebody who's, you know, known to the pastor says, hey, you really need to get more involved in apologetics. I really wish you would bring somebody out. I got this guy, Jim Wallace. Would you consider bringing him out? And so the pastor says, finally, yes, okay, fine, bring him out. And when I get there, I can tell that the deacon or the elder or whoever it was in the congregation who wanted me to come, that's one guy or one gal, but the pastor does not really have any interest in this. And I have to, the first thing I have to do is to win over the pastor. And so that's the thing that is most challenging. And you know, if you did an event and you titled it apologetics. Most people don't understand what that means, but if you articulated what it meant, if you have got a church of say 200, well, stand by, you're going to have about 20 people show up for that event, because there's always about 10% of the church with a capital C that are interested in case making, and this to our detriment that this is the case. As a matter of fact, that's why I think we're seeing so many young people struggle in those years in which they are walking away from. And I do think that the rise of the nuns, those people who claim no affiliation, you know, when they check the box, you know, what affiliation do you have?
Yes.
Is it Jewish or Christian or what denomination of Christian or whatever it is? Mm-hmm. They'll put none. Mm-hmm. You know, so this is the group that I think for the most part was probably always in our churches when it was popular to be a Christian, and now that it's not as popular, they're kind of stepped out. But here's what I think is so encouraging. I wrote an article on this yesterday, is that these folks do not claim to be atheists yet. As a matter of fact, while Christianity, people who claim Christianity, has dropped almost 8% in the last 7 years, atheism has not risen during that same period by 8%. It's only risen by 1.5%.
Mm-hmm.
So those folks are not saying, hey, I'm an atheist.
Yeah.
They're saying, I just don't think Christianity is where I want to be.
Yeah.
So we've got an opportunity right now
right.
to make the case for Christianity to a group that are still theists one stripe or another.
Yeah.
They still believe in the supernatural. They still believe in all those foundational kind of things you have to have in order to make a case for Christianity. They're just not Christians.
Yeah. Yeah.
So now is the time, I think, to make the case for what you believe.
Yeah, I think that's a good analysis, Jim. I think, as I think about that group of people, I tend to call them the so whats. They're in the so what stage. You know, you've not told me anything about the faith that really makes a difference in my life, and so what? What am I doing here? And I think that's a sad commentary on some of the strategies and teaching methodologies. I just saw an article here a few weeks ago where a prominent figure said, you know, expository preaching is irrelevant and needs to be discarded. And I was dismayed by that. We have the Word of God in all of its glory, and we have a responsibility to present it in all of its beauty and its strength and its challenges. And yet, too many pastors are sidestepping that responsibility, but be that as it may. So when we're talking about the Gospels, Jim, one of the primary strengths is the fact that they are eyewitness accounts. Now, how important is this when establishing the validity of the Gospels?
Well, I think this is, you know, some people will say, well, how can you even consider them to be eyewitness accounts? Clearly, there's two, Matthew and John, where we know that Matthew and John were eyewitnesses of Jesus.
Yes.
Now, people have attacked the authorship of these. I've written a lot about the authorship of the Gospels on coldcasechristianity.com, so I won't go through all that case right now. But if you read those two Gospels, it's clear that they are written as though somebody saw something they wanted us to believe happened, especially John's Gospel, where he's saying repeatedly, hey, I wrote this so you would believe.
That's right.
So, I mean, the idea that these were not intended to be eyewitness accounts, I think is ludicrous, given the context and the contents of the actual accounts themselves. Now, you know that Luke, he'll tell you he's not an eyewitness to this. He's actually instead speaking to all the eyewitnesses. He kind of comes into the act during the book of Acts with Paul, as a friend of Paul's, but he clearly has access to all the eyewitnesses. And I talk about this a lot in my book, too, and he is making a case to Theophilus, both in the book of Acts and in his own gospel, based on what he's learned from those who actually had knowledge of Jesus.
Yes.
Although he didn't know Jesus personally.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you've got Mark. People will say, well, look, you can't trust the authorship of these Gospels. Really? Well, think about this for a second. You've got two Gospels, Luke and Mark. And if you're going to argue that this is a kind of an ancient tradition to stick a name on a Gospel to make it seem legitimate, we have some Gnostic Gospels and some false Gospels, the Gospel of Judas, the Gospel of Thomas, you know, these Gospels that come up very late in history in which they're given the name of a disciple in order to legitimize the Gospel. Well, if that's the case about our canonical Gospels, why in the world would an ancient a deceiver trying to convince us that this actually occurred put Mark's name on the gospel?
Right.
I mean, who the heck is Mark? He's not even part of the 12. Now, what we have is an ancient kind of lineage of information, starting with Papias in the very early in history, indicating that Mark is scribing for Peter.
Mm-hmm.
Now, interestingly, the Mark's gospel doesn't take Peter's name. it stays with Mark. I mean, there's a certain honesty, mm-hmm. even at the detriment of the claim, that is refreshing in the Gospels. If you were trying to deceive us, call it the Gospel of Peter. No, it's the Gospel of Mark, who was Peter's, you know, assistant in mm-hmm. Rome, listening to everything that Peter said, writing this Gospel.
Writing it down.
So again, even Mark's Gospel reflects the eyewitness account of Peter's. And by the way, if you examine Mark's Gospel, I do this in Cold Case Christianity, forensically, to see, does it really have the fingerprints of Peter on it? You'll be amazed at what you find. It's actually kind of funny. But yes, I do think it has all the earmarks and all the kind of fingerprints of Peter on Mark's Gospel.
Yes.
But the point is, these, I think, are clearly attempts to make us believe that somebody saw something and is going to report that something to us. So the question simply becomes, do we believe it? But the idea that these are something other than eyewitness accounts, in the sense that, you know, an eyewitness account is simply this. Something happened. Somebody saw it. And then somebody offers what they saw on a first-hand perspective. We've got two of those with Matthew and John, but we also have a good accounts of the other two, not from their own perspective, but what they actually are the interview for us. It's kind of like a supplemental report that I get from 1979 where an mm-hmm. officer interviews an eyewitness, and the eyewitness says these five things happened. Well, the eyewitness is not the author of that supplemental report. The detective is the author of that supplemental report, but I will still accept what the report says as an accurate reflection of what the witness said.
Mm-hmm.
So in the end, we're doing the same kind of thing with these Gospels.
Yes. You've just described, in a sense, direct, indirect, and corroborative evidence, haven't you?
Absolutely. And, mm-hmm. You know, this is now look, people will say, well, can you even trust eyewitness accounts? I mean, eyewitnesses, well, you're right, I don't trust. What I love about indirect evidence, which is also called circumstantial evidence, which is everything other than eyewitness accounts, is that that stuff is up to me to investigate, up to me to determine what it's telling me, what it infers. And it's not trying to deceive me. You know, this kind of evidence, materials evidence, fingerprints, circumstantial evidence that points in a certain direction, it's not trying to intentionally deceive me. It's just what it is, and you have to assess it. But eyewitnesses do sometimes try to intentionally deceive you. So I always say that I don't accept what any eyewitness says, even when it helps me. I don't accept it without testing it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't just blindly trust. And if someone says you can't trust eyewitnesses, I'd be the first to agree. No, you're right. You can't trust eyewitnesses. I never trust eyewitnesses. Instead, I test them. If they pass the test, well, then I accept what they don't.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to offer a test first. And that's what we do in cold cases. We're trying to show Christians how and precisely do we test eyewitnesses, and let's apply that to the gospel accounts.
Yes. And is it true, Jim, that when you have minor details that are different among eyewitnesses, that that's actually a good thing?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this. Well, first of all, it's reality.
Mm-hmm.
This is what every set of eyewitnesses look like. I mean, if God was trying to produce for us, because clearly we could just have one account.
Yeah.
We could have one robust, synthesized account.
Mm-hmm.
Patient actually tried to do this late in history and make one synthesized kind of account. And we've seen parallel gospels have been written in the past, you know, but we don't have that. Instead, we have gospels that are very early, that coexist early in history. So even if you bring in a late dating for John, you're going to have Gospels available to readers in the first century that even then didn't line up.
Mm-hmm.
The same things that have been brought to our attention by the modern-day skeptic about the differences that appear to be in the Gospels were there from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody flinched back then, because this is the nature of eyewitness accounts. They are going to have a certain... We even have jury instructions that we offer jurors so that they will not discredit as unreliable an account just because it seems to be different
mm-hmm.
than another account that exists that's out there. And so we have to realize that people have a different perspective that's based on their geography in the room at the time of the crime. It's based on their interest set. It's based on whether they were feeling threatened and started to have tunnel vision on certain things. I mean, there's lots of reasons why witnesses appear to disagree about certain issues.
Yes.
And I can tell you in my professional work that the things they disagree about are far more dramatic than what you see in the Gospels. I mean, I've had cases where you wonder if the same two people are even at the same crime. Are we talking about the same crime here? You know, but it's because there is this level of variation,
mm-hmm.
you see. It does not mean that these witnesses are lying to you. It just means that there's a certain, you know, give me an example of this. If I want to know what the suspect was wearing at the time of the crime from three witnesses, do you actually think I'm going to ask a guy that question? I'll be honest with you. I'm not going to ask a guy that question. I'm going to ask the girl that question. Because, you know, there's a certain sense that what guys pay attention to, the guy will say, oh, it could have been a T-shirt. I'm not even sure what he was wearing. But ask me what kind of gun he had. I can tell you some great detail on that. Everyone's going to come at it with a certain interest. Now, if that woman happens to be an expert shooter at the range every week, I'll ask her about the gun. The point is, whoever has a certain amount of expertise will always pitch the observation in a way that's consistent with their expertise.
That's right.
So we would expect to see variations.
Yes.
That's exactly what I saw. That, by the way, that never bothered me as an atheist who was a new investigator of the Gospels. That never, the fact that there were variations, that didn't bother me.
Yeah.
What bothered me was the existence of the supernatural.
Mm.
You know, I could have accepted all of this. If you take out the miracles,
sure.
I don't think anyone on the planet would challenge the reliability of the Gospels if you removed the supernatural.
Right.
What bothers them are two things. Number one, we are philosophical naturalists. Usually, most of us, when it comes to science, when it comes to history, we reject those things. We want to make a different category for anything that's supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's number one. Number two is that this actually makes it this is a character in a reality that, if true, places certain demands on our life. And nobody likes to have demands on their life.
Right.
So these are the two things, that are really problematic. These are the two things that I think keep most of us who are non-believers from just jumping in.
Yeah.
Because clearly, without the supernatural elements, well, what in the world? You've got all the archaeological corroboration you could want. You've got the proper use of names in a time in history where it would be remarkable to actually pick the right names, the right geography. You know, you've got all the internal things that I've talked about in the book that line up. You've got some of the forensic things I talk about in the Gospel of Mark. You know, you've got a lot of data points that really help you. You've even got ancient accounts in the first century which seem to touch upon these data points. You've even got a chain of custody which you can see if there's any variation over time or if this thing is changing over time. Every way you could test this, sure enough, it passed the test. So what is it that's keeping us out? Well, two things. I don't believe in the supernatural, and two, I don't like being told what to do. So it's kind of those two things are really at the core of what the problem seems to be.
Yeah, yeah, and that's inherent in the philosophical naturalistic view of rejection of the supernatural. Schaefer talked about that, and that was one of the weaknesses of modernity in that they rejected that upper story. So just so our listeners are clear, I feel compelled to point this out. Jim's just answered the question for you. What are you going to say to the skeptic who comes to you and tries to point out differences in the gospel accounts as evidence that they cannot be true? Jim just given a very good answer to that. If they all matched up detail for detail, your first assumption would be that they were contrived, not that they were independent eyewitness accounts. So that was a great answer, Jim. Thank you. Let's move on and discuss your new book, God's Crime Scene. What was the goal with that book, and how does that differ from Cold Case Christianity?
Well, what I did here in my own journey was that as an atheist, I became pretty convinced that the Gospels were passing this test of reliability that I was applying to the point where I thought, okay, what do I do now with the Gospels? I mean, what do I do? I got to do something with them. But I was still somebody who would have been considered myself to be a very committed naturalist. And so I had to really go back then and say, well, look, in order for the Gospels to be true and the supernatural aspect of the Gospels to be true, well, then you'd have to be a position as a theist. You'd have to at least believe that God exists. If Jesus is claiming to be God and he's doing the things that only a God would be able to do, well, then you'd have to kind of bite off on whether or not theism was even reasonable. And so the very next thing I did was start to investigate the case for God's existence. Because if God exists and did what is described in Genesis 1, created everything from nothing, well, then, of course, all the miracles we see in the Gospels are small potatoes.
Yes.
So it was really a matter of having to assess whether or not I thought God's existence was reasonable. And that's really what the next book does. We're not talking about Christianity. As a matter of fact, the next book really you could apply this to any theistic system, which is a personal God, and there are a few of these, right? So what I was looking at is, I use a very simple principle, and here's the principle. When you work a death scene as a homicide investigator, there are four ways to die. Only one of these is criminal. The first three, naturals, accidentals, and suicides, you know, they don't involve a homicide suspect or a murder suspect. Only the fourth, homicide, involves a suspect. And so sometimes what we're doing when we walk into a room and there's a dead guy is we're simply saying, okay, can I account for all the evidence in this room by staying inside this room? If I can, it's going to be a natural, a suicide, or an accidental. In other words, if I get there and he's got a head injury, he's got a gunshot wound, and there's a pistol 40 feet or, you know, 25 feet, you know, across the hall from the body, it's, you know, a direct line of sight from the body, but it's 20 feet away, you know, that looks pretty odd.
Mm-hmm.
But if I've discovered that the only fingerprints in the room are his, the only evidence I have in the room all comes back to him inside the room, and the gun is even his gun registered to him, and the only fingerprints on that gun are his from inside the room, well, then I've got a suicide. Even though it may look suspicious, but when you look at, you worked a lot of suicides, trust me, when you see a suicide, like a headshot, that gun's going to snap out of that victim's hand, it's going to go across the room. So you see a lot of crazy things.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, if I can account for all the evidence in the room by staying in the room, I don't have a murder.
Mm-hmm.
If I have to go outside the room because that pistol doesn't belong to him and there's bloody footsteps that are leading out the front door or there's fingerprints all over the house that aren't his, if I've got to go outside the room to explain what I'm seeing inside the room, this changes the death scene into a crime scene because now I know I've got an intruder.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we decided to do is take the same approach to the universe and simply say this: can I account for everything I see in the universe by staying in the universe? If I have to go outside in order to explain what I see inside, the most reasonable inference is that I've got an outside intruder.
Yes.
At the cosmic scale, who would that be?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking at eight pieces of evidence, and I'm offering all the responses that those who want to stay inside the room for an answer, we'll take a look at all of them. Yeah. If we're looking at consciousness or free agency or the appearance of fine-tuning in the universe or the origin of life in the universe or the appearance of design and biology in the universe or the existence of objective transcendent moral principles, whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
we're going to ask the question, can I get this stuff by staying inside the room? Here's what's been offered. Here's what people think. There's some guesses at how we might stay inside the room. And do those make any sense? If not, the best and most reasonable explanation is to go outside the room to get an answer.
Yes. No, very good. You speak on many different college campuses. You mentioned Dr. Turek and cross-examined and doing work with him. And what have you found to be the most common objections to Christianity among college-age students?
Well, I mean, there's lots of different levels. I mean, a lot of it is, from a theistic perspective, the objections to God's existence are typically based on a belief, a sense that I can get everything without having to resort to deity.
Mm-hmm.
I can get it all through some form of naturalism. If that's the case, why would I bend my knee or change my life or you know, change my course if, in fact, I can answer? You know, think about this. The mathematics at college universities is a bit disturbing in the sense that this is what I see happening. Number one, our young people are not prepared adequately. They're under-resourced. They're under-trained. They're under-equipped. We don't do a great job of this in the church, if I'm honest with you. We don't address some of the objections that are facing Christians. We don't address, you know, the evidential case for Christianity very well in our youth groups. And so by the time our students get to college, the first element, the first part of the equation is in place: underprepared, unequipped college students. Then they meet in that setting an aggressive, mostly secular, by far, that's four times more secular, four times more atheistic than the culture, are the number of professors teaching in university. They're four times more likely to be an atheist than in the general population. And they have a very low regard for Scripture. Typically, when polled, very few believe it's the Word of God. Very few believe it's reliable. So they're meeting an aggressive opposing force in university. That's the second part of the equation. So unprepared and meeting an aggressive force. That's not a good equation already, but there's a third thing. which is that they're fallen humans, just like you and me. They want to pursue their desires. They have the first chance to chase their passions without being overseen by parents. You know, they've got some freedoms here. So what you have is under-equipped, under-prepared, in an aggressive location in which they really want to chase their desire to begin with. In other words, if you can offer me, as a college student, an alternative explanation for how the universe began and how we got to this point and how life emerged and all of this, and whatever your explanation is also allows me to sleep with my girlfriend without feeling bad about it, oh my gosh, I'll see you later. I'll take that worldview, right? Because I already have this underlying desire that I just want to be able to express, that what's reining me in is my Christian worldview. If I can jettison the Christian worldview, I can do almost anything I want to do. Mm-hmm. And this is where I think the equation is so hard for students. So I see sometimes people would be happy to grasp an idea that really isn't as well developed as the Christian response, but it allows them to do what they want to do anyway.
Yeah.
So they're more likely, we have to do a little more, we have to actually give a much more robust response and answer to the life's most pressing questions, because I think young people are inclined to accept the other view even if it's underdeveloped, because they just want to run amok.
Mm-hmm.
And that allows them to do that.
Yeah.
So that's why I think it's a little more difficult for us on university campuses.
Yeah, and I absolutely agree with that. I think part of the equation is that when students are presented a robust Christian explanation worldview, and they see it for what it is, they also see the implications of it. It comes with a cost. And
right.
The context that they're living in, many of them are not willing to pay that cost. So that's one of the biggest challenges that we're facing today as apologists, as teachers, as folks that are interested in helping students understand the Christian faith. There's a great need also in the church to wake up to its mission of gospel witness. Yet it seems that getting pastors, other church leaders interested in training their fellowships in apologetics techniques is a very hard sell.
No, you're absolutely right. It's hard. Now, I think there's a way in, Mike. There's a way in to the church with apologetics. And I'll tell you what I think it is. It's like anything else that nobody wants. No one's going to purchase a car until they think they have a need for a car. No one, hopefully we're not, unless you're a Wallace, no one's going to go out and get something to eat until they feel hungry. So it really is about responding to a felt need. Okay, like it or not, this is how we operate. So I think there is a felt need, because when I go around churches and ask this question, how many of you know somebody? Either this is your own son or daughter, it's your grandson or granddaughter, it's your niece or your nephew, or the daughter or son of a friend in the church, who in their college years has walked away from the church. And if you ask that question, pretty much everyone's hand goes up.
Hmm.
Wouldn't it be nice if we could have stopped that before that happened?
Absolutely.
There is a way to stop that, parents. If you worry about your own kids embracing the worldview that you spent the last 10 years trying to ingrain, that they're about ready to walk away, which you've already seen signs, you already know it's hard to get your kids to come to church in their teenage years, you already know they're less and less interested, you already see it developing. Wouldn't you like to be able to address this? The vast majority of young people, when they ask them, why did you step away, will tell you it's because they had intellectual doubt.
Hmm.
Questions that couldn't be answered by pastors, weren't even addressed by pastors, and even their own parents couldn't answer these questions. Well, there's a way. If if for no other reason, if you don't think you're interested, be interested for your kids. Because if you think when they're in college that you're going to be able to get Cold Case Christianity or Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist or any of the great books that are out there, right, and just hand it to your students because they're the first time they've got this question now, and you think that's going to work, you're wrong. They don't want to hear from me as an apologist. The first apologist your kids need to hear from is you.
Yes.
Are you going to be that apologist? And if you're not, then you know what? You would drag your kids all over creation for a volleyball tournament or for a whatever sports program, hoping that they can someday get a scholarship. You would pay for whatever tutoring possible so they can pass their AP test. But you're not willing to do that similar kind of approach with your students to make sure that by the time they're in college, they're not completely rejecting the worldview and all the things that come with your worldview.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that there's I think when parents see it that way, that now they're energized to do something, and they already know, is it through their experience, sadly, because their kids have already walked away, or through their experience as their kids are starting to resist, that they need to do something.
Yes.
And that's where I think that's the pathway into the church.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to apologetics. We simply need to help them see the problem for what it really is.
Mm-hmm.
And once they see how bad the problem is, I think they're far more likely to do something about it.
Yeah.
Make sense?
It sure does. The evidence is all around us in the culture. I guess maybe part of the issue is parents think, well, it can never happen to my Johnny or my Sally. They'll be fine. They'll remain in the faith.
Right.
I would encourage our listeners, if this is something that you've been contemplating and thinking about approaching your pastor about, I would encourage you to do that. And there are many good resources out there. Let me suggest to you that you start with Cold Case Christianity. It's a very well written text. I think it would make a great introduction to the apologetic methodology. And speaking of God's Crime Scene, Jim, that's coming out, did I see, August the 1st?
August 1st, yeah. As a matter of fact, we are just now starting to talk about the pre-orders because it's available, hopefully, but when this program airs, it's, booksellers are sometimes take an offer away, the next day, they don't even tell you why. So right now I've noticed in one location at Christian Book Distributors, it's really a very inexpensive purchase prior to the release. So prior to, hopefully, all the way up to August 1st, it'll be at a $9.99, what they're selling it for now. But I think all these pre-order sales are typically a little cheaper. So the people who already are part of, who follow me, who have been so faithful, I want to be able to make sure they know that you're going to buy this book anyway. I want you to get it for as cheap as you can possibly get it. You know, we talked about this, Mike. We're both bivocational.
Yes.
I've been a bivocational pastor, and I'm a bivocational. I don't make a career writing Christian books. I have a pension as a detective that pays the bills. And instead, this is pure ministry. This is the stuff that I retired early so I could do. And so I'm really more concerned about getting resources in the hands of the church than anything else. If you know anything about Christian publishing, no one's going to make a lot of money selling Christian books. Okay, I'm sorry. It's just not. And then if, on top of it all, you're trying to reach that 10% of Christendom that's interested in apologetics. But yet, okay, so just, you might as well just count your blessings and go home. So, so I think really the reason why we do this is because we do want people to wake up.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. And for $9.99, that's half the price of a cheap seat ticket for a baseball game. So go out there and pre-order the book, God's Crime Scene, Christian Book Distributors. I know it's on Amazon. I saw it on Amazon.
The prices will go back and forth, on these different vendors. We're in a very interesting age right now. Those kind of brick-and-mortar bookstores are gone, and everything's online.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, I just hope whenever I see it's on sale, I just tweet it out because I want people to get it as cheap as possible.
Yeah.
So.
Jim, I'd like for you to tell our listeners where they could go, websites, what is available for them to get something in their hands, perhaps as a parent who is wanting to take one of their children through an apologetic study in their home, or perhaps it's a youth teacher who is looking for some resources to teach apologetics in the church. Where could they go and find those?
Well, for now, what I'm trying to do is do all the things I did as a youth pastor. I used to post my own weekly talks at a website, which I now moved everything over. It's all available at coldcasechristianity.com.
Mm-hmm.
So what I try to do is every week, three times, produce a 500 to 1,000 word it's an apologetics resource that I actually think you could use it as the basis for teaching a sermon. You could use it as a basis of their devotional with your family. That's 3 days a week. If you subscribe there, you'll get 3 days a week. You'll get a 400 to 1,000 word writing that'll help you make the case for what you believe. And then once a week, you'll get a video, and once a week, you'll get a podcast if you really wanted to go deeper. Now, look, I know that's a lot of investment. So I want to kind of get it as quickly into your hands. The videos are not going to be more than a couple of minutes. The podcasts are 28 minutes. The idea is to deliver material that will kind of slowly change the fabric of how you live out your faith.
Yes.
If you're somebody who's was willing to read a daily devotional. Well, what would it be like if you, if your daily devotionals were apologetic in nature, if you were really kind of making a case or examining the case? Mm-hmm. Do you think you'd talk about your faith differently with your kids?
Yeah.
That's the whole point, is that to give resources that will make the conversation on the dinner table tonight a little bit different.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And that's very, well, encouraging to me that you would mention that, an apologetics devotional, because Kathy and I, my wife Kathy, as you know, we do a morning devotional every day. And this year, because we've been married well over 30 years, and so we've been through all of the married couple devotionals that you can imagine. This year we found an apologetics devotional. It's a 5-minute apologetics, daily apologetics thoughts that kind of kick-starts your day. So we've been using that, and here's what I found. It leads into some interesting conversations throughout the day when you have an opportunity to share your faith. That is in the back of your mind, so you're already geared apologetically to start your day. So that's a great point. Very good point.
No, I mean, it's so true, because, you know, we typically, you know, how many times do you watch a show and you hear an expression on the show and you find yourself using it the next day? Because you just heard it, you know, this morning. You just heard it last night, like a song that's stuck in your head.
Yeah.
Well, that's what we're trying to do here, is we're trying to get a song stuck in your head. But this song is going to be about some little piece of evidence that will help somebody who's hung up, who is, you know, is stuck right there, who just needs somebody to give them a little gentle nudge.
Yeah.
That's what this is about. This is about trying to kind of get that idea stuck in your head so you can better use it and use it. You know, this is kind of like muscle memory, right?
Yeah,
you work
right.
out a certain way, you train a certain way. So when push comes to shove, you're not having to think about it too much. You're just reflexively reacting based on your training.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if we could train every day to think a certain way, then it's not going to be hard for our muscle memory to pull it up. That's why we train. So when you get to that point of crisis, you rely on your training.
That's right.
And police officers do this for, you know, to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the same kind of thing could work for us as Christians.
Yes, absolutely. I think it was Ravi Zacharias, too, that said, apologetics is not a silver bullet. It's not something that is going to answer every objection. It's not something that you use to bludgeon people or humiliate them. But instead, apologetics is a methodology or a set of tools in your evangelistic tool belt that you really are supposed to use to remove every obstacle so that the person you're talking to can see clearly the cross of Jesus Christ. That's the whole point.
Right.
Yeah, that's why we do it. Well, Jim, I appreciate the time that you've spent with me today on the program, and I would like to invite you to come back on maybe after your book comes out, and we can talk to us about some responses.
Yeah, I'd love to do it. Anytime, brother. Appreciate
All right.
you.
God bless you, Jim. Thank you so
God
much.
Bless you too.
Soaring Eagle Radio is a production of Transforming Word Ministries and is released under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. Opening audio montage collection created by Micah 68 Productions. Visit them on the internet at www.micah68.com for more information. Friends, remember the Apostle Paul's admonition to the believers meeting in Rome. Therefore, I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. I'm your host, Mike Spaulding. Thank you for joining us today for this edition of Soaring Eagle Radio.
Thanks for tuning in today to the Soaring Eagle Radio program. For more information about the show, write us at Soaring Eagle Radio, 682 West Grand Avenue, Lima, Ohio, 45801. You may also contact Mike directly by email at the following address, pastormike@woh.rr.com. God bless you today as you seek Him.